Joining me now is Galahad Clark, a member of the renowned Clark family who founded the iconic British shoe company Clarks. Of course, Vivo Barefoot, Galahad's brand, a brand that promotes minimalist footwear, emphasising the health and benefits of walking barefoot, are our partners in community, our annual event where we bring people together to investigate political and spiritual change, as well as having a giant, glorious festival together. All of our profits from community go to mental health organisation and addiction charities, which we certainly wouldn't be able to do without our partners at Vivo Barefoot. Galahad, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What did you think of the community festival? Because it was sort of deluged, it was difficult, there was ferocious weather, there were points where it seemed like a refugee camp there more than a festival, points where I thought, oh no, this whole thing's going to sort of collapse inward on itself like a souffle of mud.
I was stunned on it. It's the first time I'd ever been to a sober festival.
Yeah.
And I was interested, shall we say, showing up there, wondering what it's going to be like, and everyone was sort of sitting around awkwardly. But the love and the laughter, the dancing was profound and almost more fun than any other festival I'd ever been to. And the depth of connection and interaction with, yes, yeah, super cool. I thought it was a great success.
Can you tell me a little bit more about Vivo Barefoot and why you were willing to work with us? In short, how our objectives as an organisation that are about community and awakening align with the agenda of your organisation and your footwear brand in particular?
I think, first of all, I would say we're privileged in many ways to have to get to the point where we're able to sponsor a festival like that and your festival. But we're ultimately a brand about liberating people's feet, about foot freedom and a connection to nature, which obviously super resonates with everything you're doing. We're a challenger brand. We're a challenger brand to Big Shoe. And, you know, in many ways, a brand that goes beyond just shoemaking and a brand that's really helping people rediscover natural health, starting with feet.
What do you mean by that freedom for the feet? Because, like, it suggests that other footwear might be like a Japanese foot binding with our little tootsies all trussed up in a Nike or a Yeezy in ways that are sort of fundamentally bad for us. Is that part of the proposition of Vivo Barefoot?
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, we find ourselves where in the Western world where we're all walking around in shoes that are literally disconnecting us both from ourselves and from the planet, strapping loads of padding under our soles and squishing all the toes together, basically. So the basic notion is that by allowing the foot to do its natural thing, feeling the earth, allowing the body to move naturally, it's a completely sort of radical difference to what Big Shoe is basically propagating.
I never had the idea like that. Sort of the way I used to dress sort of 10, 15 years ago was quite often in a little, what I'd call a high-heeled kicky boot, a Cuban heeled, like I'd have like about a 4-inch heel and very sort of narrow sort of toed shoes. I was well into them. And somehow my feet seemed to survive that experience. Now, I recognise that there's an aesthetic consideration when like a shoe's taper at the end. And I suppose it just makes sense that if you're bunching your foot up in some sort of way, particularly for people that are wearing sort of stilettos and very narrow shoes, it's pretty obvious that anything that sort of binds a part of your body is going to be negative. And perhaps in particular a foot, where I understand there are a lot of nerve endings from the reflexology and stuff that I do, that there's part of the foot that's connected to many meridian systems within the body. And I suppose if you're binding all that up, it ain't good. But I've never sort of really considered there to be sort of a shoe industry in a way that's sort of, I don't know, dishonest, manipulative, controlling, and not upfront. Are you saying that there is, that there's something that's sort of not explicit or unfair or wrong about the way shoes
are made? I mean, we were just talking about kids. And so let's start with kids where and a child's foot is not fully formed until the teenage years. And so, you know, the bones in the foot are not fully calcified until the, so they're really soft and malleable. And you know, in the Western world, we start to put kids in rigid little heeled shoes right from the age of 4 or 5 and literally start deforming feet. In my opinion, it's like a big public health scandal that we're literally deforming and weakening kids' feet and the way they move. A bit like it's akin to giving them cigarettes.
And what, like, why in particular would that be bad for them? What kind of restriction or consequences are there from? I know you're saying like all shoes, like if I'm buying my children Skechers or if I'm giving my children Nikes or what are they into? Like most of the things that my kids wear are sort of pretty sparkly sometimes, things that light up on the sole.
Most shoes will be either, you know, will be restricting the natural development of the foot. And you don't want to restrict any natural development of your kids, right? And so most kids in the Western world, they arrive in adulthood with pretty weak, deformed feet. And, you know, the studies show that just by walking around in less shoe for 6 months, you regain 60% of your foot function and health, which is not to say that barefoot makes you stronger. It's just to say that what's happening is the shoe industry are making your feet really weak and dysfunctional. And then you pay for it up the rest of the kinetic chain, right? You pay for it with people going around with bad knees and bad hips and bad backs. And, you know, a lot of kids are able to, but they don't enjoy moving anymore, right? They don't enjoy moving as much as they should. There's a whole kids' orthotic industry where they feel like they need intervention. You see kids playing sport, bandaged up in this way, that and the other. So, yeah, I would say we're quite a long way away from just our natural healthy function, starting with kids.
Well, why would that be? Because it's sort of, it's not obviously a deliberate attempt to maim and undermine the anatomy of children. And there are two sort of ideas that we're simultaneously running. One idea is that the shoes are sort of unconsciously binding up feet. The other one is that it's sort of disconnecting you from the earth in a literal way, almost in a sort of like, I'm barefoot right now and I've got one of those grounding mats and stuff. Like, are you addressing, as well as sort of biomechanical matters, are you thinking about it in a slightly more esoteric way that it's always disconnecting you?
Yeah, well, absolutely. But all of the above, it's, you know, we're designed over millions of years to, and our feet are sensory organs for a reason. They're designed to feel. They're really super complex bits of kit, right, with 28 bones, hundreds of muscles, thousands of nerve endings. And the modern shoe industry literally undermines every one of those systems, sort of one by one almost, right? The padding undermines the nerve connection. The stiffness undermines the muscles being able to dynamically use. Don't use it, you lose it. And then the shapes squash all the bones together and literally deform the bones. So if your feet aren't working and all three of those systems start in your feet and then go up the rest of your body, you then have to wiggle your body around to overcompensate, right? And so I don't think, the shoe industry and shoe executives of today are not necessarily like deliberately maiming children, but it's a laziness, right? And it's a fashion thing. And I think a lot of them know it. And I talked to a lot of them. I know the industry, and obviously my family's been responsible for making a lot of kids' shoes. But it's just a laziness of like, oh, the consumer's not ready to wear. They want their little kids to look like adults in fashion products.
So you're saying children's shoes in particular should be as non-interventionist as possible. And is that the idea of Vivo Barefoot?
That's
that they're
the
just
idea.
They're just, all they're doing is protecting your foot from stepping on glass or abrasive surfaces. They're not doing anything other than that. That's all a shoe should do.
Humans, we don't have hooves or trotters. We're really sensitive feeling feet. And we invented shoes as one of some of the first tools, probably hundreds of thousand years ago in Africa, to protect us from heat. Or, if, you know, and then when we started wandering out of Africa and across the mountains and up into the Arctic, we needed thermal protection the other way, cold protection. And then we also needed protection, puncture protection, as we started crossing difficult terrain to inhabit the rest of the world. And shoes have been made by humans in this way for hundreds of thousands of years, right? Starting with made out of antelope skin in Africa, all the way to the reindeer moccasins worn by the Sami in the Arctic, bison moccasins that the first peoples in America would have worn, or papyrus woven sandals and worn in the rainforests of Asia, etc. And they were all just very simple protective foot coverings that allowed the foot to do its natural thing. And it's not until recently, and sort of when horse riding came along and stirrups and royalty and fashion, that we all started prancing around needing pointy shoes and heels to, and one thing led to another. And we found ourselves, you know, in the 20th century in this kind of weird struggle to emancipate ourselves from nature in many ways. And we got sort of bamboozled by technology. And so companies like Nike and Adidas came along and started selling a lot of technological solutions.
There's a few things here, though, because on one hand, right, is the minimal intervention should be a component of clothing. Like there isn't another part of your body that you'd bind up. You wouldn't put a hat on that sort of strapped your head up and made you a little coned.
Right? The women of the 18th century used to wear extraordinary, you know.
What about the necklaces that make your neck longer?
For example,
you could do that for
corsets.
A little while.
We used to wear the corsets women used and to bone corsets. And
we're about like so. The only thing of like those various technologies that are about sort of deliberately warping and altering shape in order, sort of, some say, to sort of enhance sexual appeal. And I suppose that's where aesthetics and pragmatism oppose one another. Like that, these items of clothing are meant to be sexy and appealing. That's sort of, you're not using things for function anymore. And that probably sort of happens as societies become more hierarchical and elitist, yeah, that you're no longer wearing things simply because you don't want to tread on a twig. You're wearing things because you want to look sexy and probably to demonstrate that you don't have to walk. Like if you're sort of travelling around in carriages, then you can wear a lovely little buckly boot where your feet are sort of tapered off into a fine little curly toe, because you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to climb a mountain or carry a sow across a meadow, which I believe is what peasant life was primarily about. But the thing is, with things like Nike and Reebok and them type of companies, those are meant to be high performance shoes. I mean, the whole, say if you take as the epitome of the sportswear shoe to be like Nike Air, the point of that is meant to be, this is the most high performing athlete perhaps of all time across all disciplines, Michael Jordan. This is the very shoes that he wears, and in some way they facilitate excellent movement beyond what is ordinarily possible, and that's based on cushioning and arch support and all of that. So how is that not true?
So starting off with the peacocking around and fashion and sexual sort of, you know, wanting to appeal to
display.
So, you know, and adults, of course, want to do that. And they've have dressed up ceremonially since the dawn of time to impress one another in one way, shape or form. And dare I say it, you and your Cuban heels, and tight trousers, pretty sexy look back in the day, right?
I believe it was. I'd like to cling to the idea that it was.
And that's fine for adults to do, right? And adults will always do that. But what then happened was that the normal shoes to be worn in civilized society became heeled dress shoes, right? And hobnail boots of the previous ages. And then, so when Nike came along, Nike started making really barefoot shoes. Bill Bowerman, the founder of Nike, was actually making shoes with no underfoot technology. And he was a running coach, but he realized that people were getting injured a lot. So he got in some doctors, say, look, what's going wrong here? And he said, well, look, the problem is everyone's walking around in heels every day. So their Achilles heels have shortened a little bit and their feet have sort of become a bit weak. So you need to make trainers that are sort of adapted to people's, the ways people's feet have adapted to smart shoes, right? And so the technology in the shoes are sort of there to overcome the problems in people's feet, rather than just getting back to helping people get strong, healthy, natural feet again. And people like Jordan and Ronaldo and whoever, the most amazing sportsmen of our time, I would posit that if they'd never worn shoes before, they'd still be able to, and they were just wearing simple barefoot shoes, and all basketball boots used to be, you know, when Converse started.
Right. Pretty non-interventionist canvas shoes, relatively wide. So you are basically saying that those apparent advances in design are mitigating problems that were created by interventionist foot binding.
It's a matrix, yeah. And once you're in it, it's tough to get out of it.
So how have you
You look at people, like, I mean, just to sort of on the Nike example, like those athletes, they literally bind their feet, right? They put so much tape around their feet, and then people like Jordan and the elite people, they get their foots then scanned. They get sort of bespoke shoes made for them, but they sort of wrap their feet in loads and loads of tape and then scan their feet and then make a shoe to that taped foot. And so, you know, it's all the more incredible that they're able to do what they do with literally bound feet.
So your premise really is that there's a requirement for a reevaluation with footwear. So how have you reached that point when your family background is a shoe company? Although I do remember when we was kids, Clark's Shoes, which was like your famous go back to school brand in this country, you'd put your foot in a little thing and they would measure the width of your, the woman would usually, would measure the width of your foot and the length of your foot and they'd go, right, yes. And so I don't know if they would ever cater for a disparity in foot size, if they'd ever go, oh, it's 8 on this one, 8.5 on the other foot. I think you would always round down.
Hey, Clarks were relatively good, and they were particularly good 100 years ago. They were a Quaker business.
Quakers,
yeah.
And do you still have a little Quake? Is it part
I
of your
still Quake
family?
Away, yeah.
Do you go to Quaker ceremonies?
Not
on
as
Sunday?
Much as I should, but you know, I still go. Yeah. And in many ways, like what Clark's was 100 years ago, and Clark's actually, funny enough, in the 19th century, were in many ways positioning themselves as a sort of barefoot shoemaker, allowing the foot to develop naturally. But Clark's, like a lot of other companies in the 20th century, sort of lost their way and got bamboozled by technology. And you see that all over. You see that in agriculture. You see that in medicine. You see that in all these big industry changes. And you know, I would say that Big Shoe was the same, and got sort of distracted by, you know, patents and technology and in the end, and forgot the natural way of doing things.
Yeah, I understand.
And Clark's actually was, you know, and Quakers by their very definition were sticking it to the man, right? They were saying, hold on, all the power is stuck in the church. They refused to swear oaths to You had to swear an oath to be able to go to university or basically do anything in society, right? And the Quaker was like, fuck that, we're not going to swear anything to anyone. So as little spiritual communities, they sort of got together and set up shop, which is sort of to basically look after themselves. And so like the Cadburys, even some of the early British banks were all Quaker businesses, and they educated themselves. And they were really, you know, in many ways pioneered that intersection between business and social justice, and they were at the forefront of the Corn Laws, the suffragette movement, the anti-apartheid movement, abolitionist movements, all those things. They were really, really involved in, you know, way ahead of where the governments and society were, and they were funding it through business.
Yes, I understand. Communities that are not formulated around the current systems of trade and economics, like Quakers from early times gone, we're going to step out of this a little bit and go our own way. So what, they were interconnected communities where they've provided their own funding, their own place of worship, their own place of commerce. How did you transition from that? Is it still Clark's, Vivo Barefoot? Is it still connected economically or financially?
We've never been economically or financially connected to Clark's. So Clark's, the family stopped being involved in Clark's.
We sold it.
Well, it's a long story, but when I was a teenager, I witnessed the family effectively getting moved aside, and outside professional mercenary management came in to run it. And I witnessed this beautiful Quaker company get, you know, really diminished, I would say, by modern capitalism. And it's a huge part of my drive in Vivo to try and, you know, build a business inspired by like those Quaker ethics and those Quaker philosophies. And, you know, in the end, we're sort of trying to stick it to the man, which is why do we want to come and support free media and you doing what you're doing and putting on festivals like you're doing and helping people reconnect back to nature and themselves and get healthy. Right. So it's
in part, there's this sort of idea of like oppositionism, but also I feel that there's the potential to set up alternative systems of trade that are independent, where there are independent businesses, independent currencies, independent communities. Seems like what Quakers tried to do is comparable to what other religious movements threaten. Like, we could, like, say part of the threat of Islam could be regarded as, oh, well, this is an alternative ideology that's setting itself up entirely at odds with modern commodifying materialistic ideologies, that you put spirituality at the heart of your systems, even at the heart of your systems of commerce. Do you think it's possible to build a successful business that has at its core spiritual principles? How do you manage the economic requirements, the commercial requirements, the challenges of profit and running a team and setting up an overhead with those spiritual principles? How do you manage that balance? Is it even a possible thing to do, do you think?
Well, you've got to be careful, obviously. And the interesting thing about Quakers were that they really respected all the great books, and they weren't sort of really following a particular doctrine. Although a lot of them were Christians, a lot of them actually had very close ties to Buddhism and things. And so you could follow any doctrine and be a Quaker. And the principle being that they respected that everybody had a direct connection to God, or in as they would phrase it, the light. And so the Quakers could sort of get away with it in a way, because they weren't sort of trying to push a doctrine onto people, as it were, right?
Traditional, saying you can do your book, we're just going to be doing this, and there's no need for mediation. We all have access to the divine.
We all got access to recognize the light in everybody. So there's no priests, there's no churches, you sit in meeting.
No
Everyone's
pulpit.
At the same level, no pulpit. You sit in silence. So silence is at the core of it all, right? And being able to sit in silence together, find consensus together, rather than, you know, driving anything. That's what they were fundamentally standing up against.
Yeah.
The modern world, how do you do, you know, how do you, because in those days they had little villages and they had physical communities where they could do all those things together. So in this kind of hybrid world we live in, where everyone's scattered all over the world, how do you pull together a group of people around a sense of higher purpose beyond just making money and efficiency and driving, you know, short-term gain? It's an interesting challenge, and probably comes back to, in our case, we try to do that through nature, basically. And we talk a lot about just reconnecting to nature and using natural principles and being inspired by living systems, and ultimately natural health, and, you know, humans being able to take themselves off grid, take responsibility for their own bodies and their own health and their own. And it starts, in our case, with your feet.
How does that starting with your feet connect you to nature? And what do you think is, why do you think there's a significant portion of people that run that get injured?
Well, you know, we're all one people standing on one earth connected by 2 feet. It's the one great leveler around the world, right? We're all standing on this earth at 2 feet. And through our feet, we feel the earth, and our feet are designed to have an incredible connection to the earth, right? So there's a lot of electrical grounding connection happening between your body and the earth, which is a really important part of our health. And actually, by disconnecting and putting big rubber blocks in between, you know, it creates a lot of health problems. And
how?
Well, an example would be in Chernobyl. Like, let's take an extreme example where the animals around Chernobyl all kind of thrived and survived on many levels, right? And they were able
subsequent to Chernobyl.
Yeah, there's a whole ecosystem there now with animal, and the idea is that they were able to process all that extra radiation and electricity in the air, because they were constantly grounded, and the earth was able to absorb. With humans all walking around in big padded shoes, the radiation gets stuck in the body. They're not able to ever discharge it in a way.
I see. And so you're saying that Vivo barefoot shoes give you literally a better connection to the ground?
Not all of them yet. We're working on it. And so
how?
We're by literally figuring out how to do conductive soles. You know, it's a really important part of, you know, the whole essence of it, right? And the nature connection.
Industrialization, by its nature, becomes unconscious. Many systems become unconscious because they are based on the reiteration and repetition of a model that is designed to create things en masse. So I suppose when you combined aesthetics and fashion with industrialization, in a sense, you lose the connection to the purpose. This probably applies to all forms of industry: mass-produced clothing, mass-produced clothes, mass-produced food. I mean, everything that you start producing en masse starts to bypass the particular and bespoke requirements of the individual and the environments that, for a long time, we evolved in harmony with. So, part of your model, your motif and your guiding principle is to remain conscious in the way that you run the business, in the commercial partners that you use, in the way that you design shoes, in what movement means and what's required for movement, and to see if you can do something like that and still run a business. So a lot of the conversations we have on here is like, what is the difference between enterprise and entrepreneurship, looking for things that could succeed in the marketplace, and a kind of ruthless, centralized, brutal capitalism that, in a sense, doesn't even care about the person consuming the product. They would call us consumers. They just want to march the transaction through blindly, blithely, and unconsciously. So I suppose what you're positing is that based on kind of Quaker principles that provided the precedent for your family business, you can have conscious models where the product itself is functional in a way that's not ignoring the way that the human body works, and that the business ethos behind it is also conscious and aware, not creating waste, not generating problems while pretending to present a solution.
We need thousands of businesses to start acting like this, as you said, right? Working on decentralized principles, putting nature at the top of the hierarchy, giving a seat to nature at the boardroom, and just starting to think, you know, get away from this mechanistic, technological thinking to a natural living systems thinking. And, you know, we need thousands and thousands of businesses like that urgently to rise up, right? And
in
scale.
A way, progressivism is one of the... There are some ideologies in our culture that are explicit, but there are also some that are so ubiquitous that they're difficult to address. And one of them is progressivism. It's the idea that we are on an ongoing, continual ascent, that things are improving. That's why even sort of quite radical intellectuals will say, no, a few years ago, the people were much poorer, diets were worse, people were living on a dollar a day, the average person this. But I think like what a lot of us sense is that there is a kind of cultural and spiritual deterioration taking place, a managed decline. So when a business model or an idea appears to be arcane or reveres the ideas of the past, it's somehow antithetical and regarded with suspicion. But there are so many different pathways that we might have chosen in the trajectory of civilization, and many of the neglected pathways I offer ought be reconsidered. Like that Quakerism, a decentralized religious movement that reveres the divine but respects your individual connection to it, acknowledges that people do require commodities, people do have businesses, people do, let's face it, eat oatmeal, that needn't necessarily mean that we have to create a behemoth, a gargantuan entity where you end up in situations where BlackRock, Vanguard, and other sort of conglomerated financial interests dominate markets to the point where entrepreneurship becomes irrelevant. I suppose what we're talking about is how monopolies prevent true ingenuity, and disconnection becomes sort of baked into those systems.
I see it all around me all the time, right? Of young, cool businesses that are purpose-led, have real vision and philosophically really interesting for the world, and, you know, along the lines of what you were just saying. But so many get to 30-40 million and they get snapped up by short-term capital, by impatient capital, whether it's private equity or big global banks, and the capital in the business suddenly puts a sort of a short-term pressure on the business, that the business can no longer act in a way that's, you know, frankly, in the interests of the original purpose, because there's just this short-termism. And that's, you know, that's something I'm really passionate about and on a mission to sort of, you know, in many ways show that businesses can scale, can stay with patient capital, can stay long-term thinking, can stay with nature at the, you know, in the hierarchy, because it doesn't happen enough in society at the moment. It's, you know, it happens a bit in Germany more because there's a lot of community banking still going on, local banking. But yeah, we're just, there's the capital in the world is so short term that it forces businesses to act in, you know, really irresponsible ways. And that's a huge problem.
Galahad, thanks for joining us, mate. And thank you for all the support you've given to community and our partners like BAC O'Connor. They help junkies and smackheads and addicts and alkies. Friendly House, the only or the first all-female treatment centre in the United States of America that we support. Trevi Women, who help women that have got kids. It's the only one in the country that does this. All of them are benefiting hugely. And I think a community festival is fantastic because we are trying to stay conscious about the kind of partners that we have. I mean, this is difficult. It's a difficult business deal to do. Thank you so much.
Thank you for everything you're doing, though.
It's going all right, isn't it?
It's going really well. The festival and this platform is huge.
Nice one, mate. Thank you.
Thank you.